Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
Have you ever wanted to take that epic road trip to that special fishing destination you have heard so much about? Maybe you have done this and it was one of the most memorable moments of your life. David Van Wee hatched an idea to travel to some of the most fabled fly fishing destinations east of the Mississippi and then wrote a book on it. Storied Waters follows along as David chronicles 35 fly fishing destinations that have been made famous by literary giants and artists such as David Thoreau, Ernest Hemingway, and Charlie Fox. It's not only a literary journey, though. Storied Waters is also a fly fishing journey, as David details some of these great locations and the flies and techniques that were proven successful. Enjoy, and please check out both our recent and coming podcast. We have recently posted some great guests and have many more coming soon, so please hit that follow button and stay tuned. Thank you. Are you a guide, a lodge, or a product manufacturer in the fly fishing or outdoor industry? I want to introduce you to and highlight Cross Current Insurance. Their entire team are great people and experts in their field. They have a guide insurance program that is amazing and very affordable. If you are a lodge or retailer, they also have programs tailored to your needs. These guys fish and are in the outdoors, so they know the industry and the landscape. To get more information on a program that's perfect for you, find them at crosscurrentinsurance.com. All right, thank you. And we are here back live on the podcast, and I am so excited to have David Van Wee, who's the author of this incredible new book that I've been reading, Storied Waters, 35 Fabled Fly Fishing Destinations, and the writers and artists who made them famous. David, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
No, it's my pleasure, because I've been reading your book, and I've really been enjoying it, because we actually start, your book starts originally here in Walden Pond, and that's where my fly fishing career started.
That's amazing.
On Walden Pond. And before we jump into it, David, why don't you give us kind of a history of the book, because the way you go about these beautiful 35 quote-unquote destinations, it's not just about the fishing, but it has a literary background too. Each of the locations that you visited have some literature or a famous author behind the waters, if you will.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's a physical journey of 6 weeks and about 5,700 miles of driving.
Wow.
That I took in May and June of 2017. But it's also a literary journey through kind of the history of fly fishing literature. And it started with a previous book that I published with six of my college friends called The Confluence.
Okay.
And in The Confluence, we have a number of stories of our misadventures fly fishing in northern New Hampshire for wild brook trout. And when we published that book, we wanted to reprint Testament of a Fisherman, which is a famous passage by Robert Traver, which is a pen name of John Volker. And we had to contact the family to get permission for copyright to republish the whole passage. And I struck up a kind of email friendship with his daughter, Gracie Volker Wood. And when we finally got permission and I sent her a copy of our book, she invited me to fish at her father's pond, which the family calls Uncle's. But in all his stories, it's called Frenchman's Pond.
Frenchman's Pond. That would be how people would recognize the name.
Yeah. So if you've ever read Robert Traver, he wrote a book called Trout Magic. He wrote Trout Madness, another one called Anatomy of a Fisherman. He's actually most famous for writing Anatomy of a Murder, which was a bestseller and made into a movie with Jimmy Stewart, George C. Scott, Lee Remick, and some other famous actors. And he did so well on that book and movie that he retired from being a Supreme Court justice in Michigan to become a full-time fly fisherman and writer. And so
we all wish.
Yeah, right. So this invitation to go fish at his secret pond was something, as an aspiring writer myself, I couldn't turn down. It's like, wow, but it's on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Yeah.
And I was in Maine.
You from originally from Maine?
I was living there for 35 years, yeah.
Okay.
So the question was, okay, how do you get to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan? Well, you're a fly fisherman. You fish your way there and back. So
if you can convince your wife, Cheryl.
Exactly, exactly. So I came up with this idea that, well, what if I went to as many other places that I could think of that are mentioned in literature that involve fly fishing and go to all of these fabled, storied waters and fish them all in one big trip.
Yeah.
And that's how the book came about. And so I started in Maine. My first stop was Walden Pond. I started with Thoreau and ended with Thoreau, partly for symbolic reasons, but he was really into fish, actually.
Yeah.
I think he might have fly fished, but I haven't found proof positive. But so I started Walden Pond, ended in the Maine woods, and I went south across southern Vermont, the Catskills, Pennsylvania, out to Wisconsin, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and then came back east through Lower Peninsula and then New York State, the Adirondacks, and then back all the way through to Maine. And my wife actually did give me a pass.
Not a hall pass, but a fishing pass.
My worry was that when I got home, she would change the locks, but she didn't. And it was a remarkable journey.
Yeah.
A fly fishing journey. A fly fishing journey, both to test your skills fishing in all these places that you never have seen before.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, trying to learn about the writers and the stories. And,
so cool.
And it was a remarkable experience. And I had literally a stack of books to the ceiling that I had to
read
and become familiar with so that when I got there, I might actually know something about that writer and that river
Well, we're going to dive headlong into all this. This is going to be so fun.
Before we jump in, I want to let you know about the new travel section we have on the flyfishingjourneys.com website. Our goal and what we are passionate about is being on this fly fishing journey with you. That's why we go to the fly fishing shows and why we have started group travel with you. For the last 2 years, we have brought select friends and listeners to Iceland for curated hosted trips. We continue that with 2 weeks in Iceland this year, which are sold out, and 3 weeks in Iceland in 24, which are starting to fill up. These trips are pre-vetted for the best weeks on the best rivers. All the accommodations and details have been thought out and handled for our guests' convenience and enjoyment. This July, my good friend Tim Kamisa and I are headed to Alaska for some salmon fishing in the Bristol Bay area. I head back to Alaska in August to experience 2 additional lodges, new rivers, and different runs of salmon. July is more kings, chums, and sockeye, where August the target is silvers. Our goal here in Alaska is similar to Iceland, getting you the most hands-on current information. We don't have any Alaska trips to offer in 23, but stay tuned for more information for 24.
Before we get into some of these kind of questions, ever since I've been reading this book, I have all these unique questions I want to ask you, but one thing I wanted to try to bring full circle here is why the testament of a fisherman, like what drove you to get permission from this forward, from this passage from Volkler?
Yeah. So I think of the testament of a fisherman as sort of the Lord's Prayer of fishing. You know, people should be able to recite it like you do in church. or the Desiderata, you know, that thing that everybody had on the wall in college. I'll just read the first couple lines because it just sets the mood if people aren't familiar with it. Traver writes, "I fish because I love to, because I love the environs where trout are found, which are invariably beautiful, and I hate the environs where crowds of people are found, which are invariably ugly. And because of all the television commercials, cocktail parties, and assorted social posturing, I thus escape. Because in a world where most men seem to spend their lives doing things they hate, my fishing is at once an endless source of delight and an act of small rebellion." I love that, act of small rebellion.
I like that.
My whole book is an act of small rebellion. So
I'm going. Fortunately, got permission.
So when we wanted to put that in the book because we did it as a reading, my group of friends were all kind of literature geeks. So after dinner, when we have, you know, somebody pulls out something and we do kind of a reading and talk about it. And that was one of them. So that's kind of how it worked its way in. But to print the whole passage, I figured I better get
permission.
Copyright permission. And that's how I became friends with Gracie and her husband, Woody, who were my gracious hosts when I got out to Frenchman's Pond. To uncles, right, exactly.
Well, before we get into uncles, because that's halfway through the story
it'll be halfway
through our podcast,
yeah.
Why did they call it uncles? Was it just uncle's place?
No, actually, what I've heard is that some people called it Uncle Tom's Pond.
Okay.
It's actually just a beaver flowage. It's not...
Nothing crazy special.
No, you know, when you get there, it's pretty. But there's about a million of them on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan of these beaver ponds. This one, Traver liked, John Volker liked, because it had springs in it and it had cold water and it held trout year round. And he, when he made enough money from his book and movie, he bought it and built a camp out there, and it became his sort of personal retreat. Sort of like Thoreau at Walden Pond, it was his place to go and rejuvenate and commune with the fish.
Yeah.
And that was his special spot.
So what did you tell your wife to convince her to let you go on this trip of six weeks?
6 weeks,
Six weeks. What did you tell her?
Well, we've kind of each done various adventures in our lifetime. She used to run track and disappear for long weekends on competing nationally in track and field. And so many years ago, we sort of learned to give each other the pass. And in a way, this was also I was retired from my career as an environmental consultant. And this is a chance, I was hoping I would do the trip, blog about it, and then turn it into a book.
Yeah.
And now, that, a lot of ifs there, because, first of all, the trip had to be interesting to turn it into a book.
Yeah.
And my fear when I started out was that I'd get 6 weeks of people saying, oh, you should have been here last week. That's when the fishing was really good. You know, it really stinks today. We got blown out or it's a drought or whatever. And so... there was no guarantee that this trip was going to be worth writing about.
Well, your first stop, Walden Pond. See, I grew up in the North Shore of Boston.
Yeah.
So when I started my fly fishing career, they said, well, you might go try Walden Pond because they have some rising trout there. Well, no one told me just how finicky these trout were going to be.
Yeah, right.
So they're pretty finicky, and we can kind of get into all that. But really what I want to know about Walden Pond is Henry David Thoreau. What did you come up with? How would you describe him to our listeners?
A lot of people know him just by quotes, and they've heard of the book Walden, or they read the book Walden, or like I did, I read Civil Disobedience, his essay, when I was in high school. But for a lot of people, he's kind of this mythical figure that we know more from second or third hand than by actually reading it. And I found that was true with me. I was going to go down there, and I realized, you know, I don't know. I haven't really read a lot of his stuff. Somebody brought along a copy of The Maine Woods, and I knew that he'd made several trips to Maine. He'd climbed Mount Katahdin. He canoed on Moosehead Lake and on the Penobscot River.
What years was this?
This is in the 1800s. This is interesting. So he went to Walden Pond, which is what everybody knows. He went and stayed in this cabin on the shore, and he writes about solitude and simplicity, and kind of he's wrestling with the role of humans and nature and society, and it's all very heavy.
Yeah, really mindy stuff here.
Yeah. So he was there for 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days.
What is the story with that? Like, why 2 years? What was behind that?
He just wanted to...
Be deliberate?
Yes, he wanted to live deliberately, he called it, and really spent time thinking about how connected he... And he wasn't really... He could walk to his mother's house for dinner. It wasn't like he was out in Alaska in the bush country. He was at a pond where... You know, a few miles walking distance from Concord. So he wasn't that far out. But for him, it was a chance for reflection.
He lived introspectively.
Yes.
And then wrote about it.
So when he was at Walden Pond, he didn't write the book Walden when he was there. He actually wrote a different book called 2 Weeks on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, which is about a 2-week canoe trip he took with his brother. And that was his first book. And so while he's at Walden Pond, he's writing about canoeing and fishing with his brother. So there's actually fishing in that book. And then when he was at Walden Pond, he took a little vacation from all that solitude and introspection, and he went to Maine and climbed Mount Katahdin. So he didn't actually stay in this cabin. It was not like he was locked in the woods for 2 years.
Right.
He was, people were coming to visit him. He was wandering around.
Like the rest
town.
Of us New Englanders.
Yeah, but he was just living in a cabin in the woods and thinking about the world. So one of the one of his excursions, he called them, was to Maine, and he went and climbed Mount Katahdin, and he and. In that story, which is in the Maine woods, he describes a scene that sounds a lot like an epic hatch with trout and salmon rising well into the night. So I think it was in late August or September, so it probably wasn't a hex hatch.
Yeah.
But he was there and fishing
right.
with friends while all these trout were rising. So he's actually got some... I'm probably the only person who's ever approached Thoreau entirely from a fishing perspective. I just wanted to know everything he knew about fish and fishing. And so that's been kind of my journey.
And then you were down towards New York where you went towards the Catskills?
Yep, yep.
And then you, one of your chapters was the Four Freedoms. Talk about the Four Freedoms and how they crept into your story.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. So I was actually, after Walden, I went over to Vermont to Manchester.
Okay.
And I actually visited Orvis, and I had Pete Kutzer from Orvis guiding me on the Battenkill. And had a decent day fishing. Did not catch a fish that day. I did have a nice big brown trout on for a few head shakes, but lost it. So after my afternoon of fishing, or day of fishing, I was heading out of town, and there's a Norman Rockwell exhibit in this little, it's called the Sugar Shack. And I thought, well, Rockwell lived here, and I thought he might have painted pictures of people fishing. So I stopped in this little shack to look for Rockwell paintings, and I was struck by his most famous four. He actually did fly fish with several other famous fly fishers who lived in the area. Lee Wolfe lived there, and he was friends with Lee Wolfe. John Atherton, who wrote a book called The Fly and the Fish. Another guy named Mead Schaefer. So all of his buddies were avid fly fishers, and Rockwell was not crazy into it, but he did give it a go now and then. But so these paintings are about, they were painted for, to commemorate Franklin Delano Roosevelt's speech during World War II about why, when people were resisting going into World War II, about why it was sort of our moral duty to think about the world. And he talked about freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from fear. And these paintings were just right there, and they struck me, especially in these political times, as particularly poignant. And I didn't really think of it be ending up in a fly fishing book.
Yeah.
But there's a connection because Rockwell was a fly fisher. And these paintings were, I thought, a little bit part of my story because I just came upon them and I had sort of seen them, you know, maybe here and there, but didn't really get the full connection. So it's almost like an aside, that little chapter is almost like an aside from the fly fishing journey, but I thought it was worth putting in the book.
And so then you ended up in the Catskills. Now, what areas did you fish in the Catskills, and what authors did you talk about? I know we were tied into Isaac Walton there a bit.
Okay, so, well, the first fly fishing story published in the United States is attributed to Washington Irving, who most people think of as Rip Van Winkle.
See, I didn't know this about Rip Van Winkle.
Yeah.
It was like a story my dad used to tell me.
Yeah, the guy, he disappeared into the...
He fell asleep.
Yeah, he fell asleep for 10 years. And it was written sort of as a parody of what would happen if you fell asleep before the revolution and you woke up after the revolution. That was kind of the premise. What's the world like?
Right.
And how much has the world changed in 10 years?
Okay.
And that's what Irving was doing with Rip Van Winkle. But the story that he wrote published at the same time as Rip Van Winkle's called The Angler. And it's about a guy going fly fishing in the Catskills. And he doesn't really love it all that much. He has an interesting experience. But he then ends up over in England, and he sort of meets this guy who's sort of a Isaac Walton character. And that is also a little bit of the just the history of fly fishing literature. That story is over 200 years old. Mm-hmm. It was written in 1819.
The Angler.
The Angler. And you can find it online. You can Google it, and that's how I read it, because it's in the public domain.
Yep.
So from there, I went across over the Catskills to the other side and fished the east branch of the Delaware, and then I fished the Beaver Kill itself.
Yep.
And a couple of the big writers, John Burroughs wrote about the east branch of the Delaware, a trip that he made where he built himself a boat and floated down it. He wrote in the late 1800s. Before that was a tailwater. Now it's a tailwater from the dams that were built to store water for New York City. And back when he was there, it was all wild brook trout. On the Beaver Kill, a lot of people have written about the Beaver Kill. Theodore Gordon, of course,
right,
was the father of the dry fly in the United States. Fished there, and there's a pond called the Gordon Pond. There's Hendrickson's Pool. This is a very famous river,
yeah,
that steeped in fly fishing history. My favorite author is Corey Ford, and he learned to fish there and wrote several stories about fishing on the Beaver Kill. And I just love Corey Ford's stories.
Did you connect at all with, like, the museums at all? Because I know they have the Catskill Museum down there. And
Yes. Actually, so when I was in Manchester, I went to the American Museum of Fly Fishing.
Yep.
And then I went to the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum.
Yep.
And then I decided, well, okay, what other museums are there? I'll build them into the trip. So I also went to Pennsylvania.
Right.
I went to one in Michigan. I went to the one in Maine. I went to one in the Adirondacks. So there's some great fly fishing museums that are fun to go to, and I built them into the trip as well.
We're going to take a short commercial break to hear from Tim O'Neill of Norvice.
What makes the Norvice different than another system?
There are a lot of rotary fly tying vices out there. The Norvice is the only vice that will truly spin when you tie flies, and there's a big difference between rotating a vice slowly and spinning it at a bit of a faster RPM. And being able to spin the hook on a zero axis rotations opens up a lot of doors for us in the world of fly tying.
Tell me about the introduction of colors to the Norvice system.
When we obtained the company from Norm, he said to me just a very, very short statement. He said, you know, I always thought a colored Norvice would be a cool item. We brought out five colors: Radical Red, Sunset Orange, Shamrock Green, Liberty Blue, and Royal Purple. We have five colors along with the black that you're accustomed to seeing with Norvice, and we've been doing very well with those.
To find more information and their online store, visit nor-vice.com.
So then you moved off into Pennsylvania from New York.
Yep.
And once you get into the State College area, PA, you get into the Latorte, the Yellow Breeches, Spruce Creek, Spring Creek, and others. Why did you choose this area?
Well, I started with a few days in the Poconos with a good friend of mine who has a place on a stream called Mud Run, which is at a private club called Greystones. And Pennsylvania, a lot of the eastern water in eastern Pennsylvania, a lot of it is private club water. That's sort of part of the history of fly fishing as well. But out in Pennsylvania, in western PA near State College, kind of got connected through a friend of a friend who said he would take me to Spruce Creek and Spring Creek. Spruce Creek is kind of famous because Jimmy Carter would fish there. He was one of several fly fishing presidents, and he and his wife Rosalind fished in Spruce Creek, and he wrote about that in his book called a memoir called An Outdoor Journal. And so I got to go fish where Jimmy Carter had fished. That was one connection to stories. And the other one was Spring Creek is where George Harvey, Joe Humphreys, and a number of others have fished there. George Harvey was the first college professor to teach fly fishing as a four-credit class, which actually there are quite a few schools that do it now because it involves so many aspects of ecology, water quality, you know, biology.
Yeah.
So there are other schools that actually include fly fishing as a
But George Harvey was the original.
He was, yeah. He did the first one. So we got to fish. We got to fish Spring Creek there, which is a. I had never fished those classic limestone streams before.
Yeah.
So that was a new experience.
Yeah.
For me.
Did you like it?
Yes, it is. You know, you have that milky water. You have different insect life. The hatches are a bit more regular, and being from Maine and New Hampshire, we don't get sort of the classic yeah. hatches that people can set their watch and say, well, the sulfurs are going to be coming off at 7:30
right.
on June 12th, and everybody lines up in the parking lot
I know.
To get ready. We just don't really
they're
have that.
Yeah, they're more New England freestoners. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fishing stone flies.
Well, or caddis flies that are hatching all the time.
Right.
We do get green drakes and we get, you know, the hex hatch and other things like that, which are people sort of wait for those. But if you spend all your time just thinking you're going to fish hatches in New England,
no.
That's not kind of the way it works. But it was fun to do that and fish. And then we got down to the Breaches and fished near Boiling Springs. And I went over and made a few ceremonial casts into the Latorte Spring Run
yeah.
right behind the Pennsylvania Museum, that's one of the hardest streams in the world to fish. And I didn't figure I was going to solve it in an hour and a half.
No, so, it's a tough river.
So I just
kept moving.
I just did it because I wanted to be able to say I threw a fly into the
yeah.
Latorte.
So if you're going to wet a line in Wisconsin, you're going to know about the Driftless area. First of all, why is it called the Driftless area, and what makes it so special?
The Driftless area is called that because that's an area of southwest Wisconsin, southeast Minnesota, northwest Illinois, and northeast Iowa, right where all the four states come together.
No kidding.
And that area was missed by the last couple glaciers when we had the big polar ice caps. For some reason, they went around that area and didn't carve it with all the ice and build up big piles of sand and till like you see on Cape Cod or
yeah.
Michigan and elsewhere. So when the glaciers retreat, they leave all that crud behind that they scrape off the landscape. They didn't do that in this area. And so geologists call the stuff that glaciers leave behind glacial drift. And I don't know where that word came from, but that's what they call it.
Yeah.
So it's the Driftless area because it doesn't have any drift.
No drift.
No drift. No glacial drift. So the glaciers missed it. So the actual landscape is very different. It wasn't carved by glaciers. The valleys and the hills are a different geography. And it's full of limestone streams, small limestone streams all over the place. And these limestone streams are full of native brook trout and brown trout. Now, unfortunately, that area got hit pretty hard during the Dust Bowl. The farmers over-tilled the land. They stripped the forest off. And those streams were devastated back in the 1930s. During the Dust Bowl, but they've been restored. And
okay.
Aldo Leopold, who was one of my environmental heroes, was instrumental in doing some watershed restoration projects out there. And one of the areas I visited was called Coon Valley, which is the site of the very first large-scale watershed restoration project in the 1930s that Leopold was sort of spearheading. And they turned those streams into blue ribbon trout streams. And I got to go check it out. And if I was going to go back and fish somewhere, that's one of the places I'd go.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah. It's the Driftless area was spectacular.
Wow.
You're fishing a lot of the times you're in farm fields with cows grazing in the pasture near
yeah.
you. It's not like you're in the Rockies or Patagonia or something. It's not that kind of spectacular. But it's just the streams and the watersheds and the fish were beautiful.
What type of fishing were you doing? Mostly brown trout? Or?
A lot of the southern way west from Vermont, southern Vermont, all the way across was mostly brown trout fishing. That's because they do better in water that's a little warmer.
Right.
And then when I was on my way back, the northern way, returning the northern route, more brook trout and
rainbows.
And some rainbows. Always still brown trout here and there,
mm-hmm.
but the Driftless area is known for having wild brown trout. They're not native. Brown trout are not native anywhere in North America,
right?
But they are wild out there.
Well, here we are. We're coming to the halfway point of your journey. You've reached the halfway point, and the original purpose of your trip, Frenchman's Pond or Uncles.
Yep.
So describe Uncles for us.
Well, it's actually not the biggest, most spectacular pond you would imagine. It's a typical Northwoods beaver pond,
okay.
Beaver flowage. It's a stream that the beavers have dammed for probably hundreds of years. It has beautiful alders and willows growing around it, and it's spring-fed, so the trout hold over all summer. And the best part about it is up there, it's pretty remote. And I got to go stay and fish at the camp that Volker, or Robert Traver, built. And one of the lines in Testament of a Fisherman is about fishing is that bourbon from an old tin cup always tastes better out there. And one of the highlights of my visit was that I got to sit in his chair and his cabin and drink bourbon out of an old tin cup. So that was a little bit of a nice little poetic flourish. But it just, for me, it was really more the history and the legacy of one of my favorite writers and getting to go and fish in his pond and catch trout out of, you know, right out of the same place where he did. And
the testament.
Yes, the testament. And there's,
did you recite it while you were there?
Yeah, I mean, the lines are, they pop into your head.
You don't have to recite it. It's just kind of in you.
Yeah, it's right there. In one of his stories called A Flick of a Favorite Fly, he writes about getting a visit from Art Flick, who wrote Streamside Guide to Insects and Their Hatches. And Art Flick, of course, is a famous writer, going out to visit another famous writer. And Volker felt great pressure to make sure that Art Flick caught a fish. And he writes about this in one of his stories. So I got to fish with Woody, who is my host, in the exact same spot where Art Flick and Robert Traver are trying to hook him up on a trout. And Woody caught one right in that same spot. And it's the way it's described in the story and the way it looks is pretty much the same.
That's so really, cool. Really, really neat. I'm going to do a quick aside here. Yeah. You must know Bob Romano.
Yep.
Okay, yeah.
Yep.
Awesome
yep.
guy.
Yeah, yeah. Because
you two remind me very similar to each other. He's been on our podcast, and,
yep.
you know, he has some great Maine stories.
Yes.
And is a great Mainer.
Yeah.
Well, a New Yorker, I guess, in Maine.
I think he lives in Northern Jersey.
Northern New Jersey, yeah.
But he has a camp up in the Rangeley area.
Yeah.
And he writes, he's got a number of books about fishing up there. And actually, that's kind of my home water.
Okay.
When I lived in Maine, I fished a lot with my friend Lou Zambello, who's also a writer, who
yep.
you should have on your podcast if you haven't yet. But Lou and I fished up in the Rangeley area on the Magalloway. We fished the Rapid, the Kennebago.
Yep.
And so... So Bob's water is my water.
And mine.
Yes.
That's all my home water
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
So three peas in a pod here.
Yeah,
but
right.
I mean, you guys have more literature than me. I'm more of a media guy.
There
so
you go.
I'm more of the audio word and the
okay.
video word. You guys are the written word.
There we go. There we go.
But before we get, we're heading to Maine. We're having
right, we made the corner and now we got to come back.
Yes. And now you're on the Fox River here with Hemingway.
Yeah, so Hemingway's most famous fly fishing story is called Big Two-Hearted River. And if you've never read it, you should read it. It's a great story. It's about Nick Adams, who's one of his semi-autobiographical characters, who is back from World War I, just as Hemingway was. He's wounded, and he's trying to recover from the war. And he goes off on this fishing trip. And he goes up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. He hops off the train in the town of Seney. And he walks up the river to go fishing. And in typical Hemingway, the war is never mentioned, but it's everywhere in the story. You can sort of sense
wow.
it. He doesn't talk about it.
Doesn't say the word.
Hemingway called that the theory of omission. It's what you leave out of the story that is actually sometimes the most important part.
A character.
Yes. So Nick Adams is up there fishing. Well, turns out that there's actually a river in Michigan called the Two-Hearted River. But that's not where the story took place. The story took place on the Fox River. And it's in a place where Hemingway actually fished when he was a young man with a bunch of his friends. And they went up, and he claims in his biography that he caught over 200 fish. And so that's where he puts Nick Adams. And when I was doing the trip, I visited the Fox River hoping that I could maybe catch some of those 200 fish like Hemingway did. Unfortunately, it had been pouring rain for like 2 days. So that was one of the places where I should have been there last week.
That happens, right?
Yes, it did happen.
The Fly Fishing Show Tour travels the country every winter. From January until March, the largest consumer fly fishing shows in the world will be in one of six locations. The regular stops are Marlboro, Mass., which covers the New England area, Edison, New Jersey, which is the New York, New Jersey, Mid-Atlantic States show, Atlanta, Georgia, Denver, Colorado, Pleasanton, California, the Bay Area show, and finally back to where it all started in Pennsylvania at the Lancaster show. These shows are super fun events that are packed with teaching, presentations, and everything you could ever want to know or see in fly fishing. Find all the details at flyfishingshow.com.
So you kind of cruise by, you hit the Au Sable in Michigan, and then you head towards the Adirondacks. Tell us a little bit about the Adirondacks.
So first of all, it's the Au Sable in Michigan.
Au Sable.
It's the Au Sable in New York.
So, got it.
So in Michigan, it's capital A-U, capital S-A-B-L-E, and that river is spectacular.
Okay.
And I fished there, had a great time there, and then I had to cut across Ontario and went to the Adirondacks. And then I fished the west branch of the Au Sable and I see the folks right across from us here at the Hungry Trout Resort. I stopped in the Hungry Trout fly fishing shop and bought a few Au Sable wolves and Au Sable bombers and was able to coax a few really nice big old brown trout to take those storied flies.
That's really cool.
It was pretty cool.
On the Au Sable.
In New York, right.
In
right.
New York.
Yep. The other cool thing, two other things about the Adirondacks. One is my grandfather used to go there, and he belonged to a private club called the Ghoulie Club. And he was a photographer. And in the story, I talk a bit about how he had these photos from the turn of the century, 1900, 1910, 2030, that I don't know the stories.
Mm-hmm.
All I have is the photos. And so I talk about it, I call it untold stories, because I have these photos of my grandfather and I don't know what's going on. He was there at this also. Winslow Homer was, and this is where the writers and artists who made them famous, we already talked about Norman Rockwell, but Winslow Homer painted a number of amazing photos of trout and fly fishermen and guides in the Adirondacks. So I was sort of exploring, their two camps were right across the Hudson River from each other. So the two of them could very well have
been buds,
bumped into each other on the river and borrowed, bummed a fly off of somebody or said, hey, what'd you catch that on, pal?
And kind of like Kerry Stevens up in Maine.
Yeah, right, right.
Very cool. Well, you know, you have these little sections here called the Weir and High, and you have the Au Sable River in New York.
Yeah.
And I have to make mention of these here because I very deliberately read your section that you had for the Walden Pond, the how and why, and it was dead on, man. It was really, really perfect. And it was everything that I remembered from Walden Pond, including those tricky little midges that come up at night.
We didn't even get a chance to talk about that. You asked me that question, and we never got there. So, the trout there rise to midges. Lou Zambello, in his book, Fly Fisher's Guide to New England, he fished there, and he did get a couple, or at least he claims he did.
Lou we're talking about here.
Right, I know. He's my best friend. So, but we met another guy there who was catching them on green woolly buggers on sinking line. I did not hook a trout when I was there, but I did manage to catch a smallmouth.
And Very cool.
The smallmouth were spawning in the shallows when I was there, and I got a couple of nice ones on poppers. And those sidebars, my editor at Stackpole, Jay Nichols
yep.
wanted me to put the where and hows in there so that people reading this could have some idea, maybe pick up a tip or a way to approach each of the some of these destinations yeah. and have a whack at some of the fish.
We're going to skip ahead here a little bit because we want to leave a little bit of mystery here for the reader
okay.
here. We don't want to give
right.
away all the stories. Otherwise, they're not going to have to buy your book. So
yeah, we want them to buy the book.
We
got to
have them buy the book, and they certainly should because our next point I want to talk about here is a place that I love. I've caught some nice fish up there, caught one of my bigger brown trout before I headed to Iceland. And that's the Upper Connecticut River.
Yep.
And tell me about your stories from the Upper Connecticut.
Well, that one starts with my daughter because
okay.
she was living in Lancaster, which is right near the Upper Connecticut. But to fish the Connecticut Lakes, you still got to drive another hour and a half north. And so I stayed with her, and I had fished part of the Upper Connecticut with Lou before, and we caught some nice rainbows and a few browns. But I was meeting a couple friends from Trout Unlimited up there, and we went to fish the trophy stretch that's up between the lakes. And we had we keep hitting the ones where I didn't catch fish. I actually did catch fish on this trip. But on this day...
It's a journey, man. It doesn't matter.
I know. No, it really never bothered me if I didn't. I mean, I want to catch them like anybody. In fact, there's a funny passage in here because I'm fishing with my friends. They're catching fish. We meet this guy, and probably one of the few sort of semi-nasty passages in here. But this guy, he hooks a fish, somebody I don't know, and he brings up one, and one of the most smug comments of, I've been catching, you know, on every cast on this nymph. And I was not feeling so charitable that
yes.
afternoon, so I was calling him, you know, names
mm-hmm.
In the book, but he was a little smug for
He's
me.
Smug, yeah.
yeah.
So he got what he deserved.
Hey, he was catching fish and I wasn't. So
he's gonna read the book. He's like, whoa, that's me.
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
Well, so for the Upper Connecticut, for people who don't know, that's Northern New Hampshire.
Yes.
You know, it's Northern
yes.
New Hampshire. It's the top of the Connecticut River.
Yeah.
As it goes, comes out of Quebec and into New Hampshire, and then it's a beautiful stretch of water there. Throughout that northern New Hampshire section of the Connecticut River.
Yeah. Yep.
I love it. It goes through the first Connecticut Lake, second Connecticut Lake,
right.
Back Lake.
Yeah.
Oh, no, Back Lake is actually off the chain.
Yeah.
So it's first, second, third, and then...
I'm trying to remember the one that's got a name. Lake Francis.
Lake Francis. We
yes.
got it. We got it. And then Back
Brain
Lake.
Cramp. Yeah.
yeah. Back Lake, which is not in the chain, but it's also they
yeah.
considered the fifth Upper Connecticut
yeah.
Lake. So it's a beautiful area.
Yeah, there's great fishing in there, and there's a number of guides here at the show that the Lobstick Camps and a
yeah.
number of other people.
Paul Timber.
We'll take you down there.
Yeah.
I've got to get up there more. I actually live now in Lyme, New Hampshire, and I live right on the Connecticut River, but it's the lower Connecticut River where it's warm water.
Yeah. It's,
and
yeah.
I got to get up and do some more
yeah.
up there.
Well, we're going to come up to the close, which is after I got started in the Walden Pond area with my canoe
yeah.
in the ponds. I heard about these beautiful, beautiful waters of western Maine, the
yeah.
Rangeley Lakes area,
yeah.
the Rapid River, the Kitsuptik,
yeah.
the Kennebago, the McGalloway.
Yep.
Beautiful, beautiful water. And then you have some a very special author to me. Her name is Louise Dickinson Rich because I was giving a book, We Took the Woods,
yeah.
by a very good friend of mine. His name is Aldro French,
yeah.
who I fished with in the late 90s
yeah.
and fished together. I've been up to the Forest Lodge many times.
Yeah.
And so Aldro's a great friend of mine. So I was so excited to see you have this section here.
Yeah, this chapter actually was published in The American Fly Fisher by the American Museum of Fly Fishing. They published it when it was in blog form. But... This was one of the most, and I think I related it pretty well in the chapter. It was one of the most unexpected great times on this trip because I thought that I was going to meet Aldro and just say hi and get a little quick tour and maybe throw a few lines in the river. I had fished the rapid once before, and when I got there, he put me up for the night, fed me dinner, fed me breakfast. He treated me like his best friend, and it was a really, really special experience. And
for sure.
I can't thank him enough. He doesn't actually own the the lodge anymore.
Right.
But he does send me a note now and then, and that experience was pretty cool. I got to stay in the winter house where Louise Dickinson Rich and her husband had stayed in the winter because the other house was too cold.
Yeah.
And that and the Rapid is it's a world class river.
Yeah.
There's a couple of pretty nice pictures of fish in there.
That yeah.
I got some nice brookies there and a few salmon.
Well, tell our listeners about Louise Dickinson Rich and the book We Took to the Woods.
Yeah. So she wrote the book. It was, I believe it was published in 1939. So most of the stories were written in the 30s. Her husband, Ralph, was a retired engineer an engineer who dropped out of the corporate rat race, which is I thought was funny because I didn't know there was a corporate rat race in the 1930s, but apparently there was. And he just decided to live out in the woods, sort of like Thoreau. And she met him when she was on a canoe trip with her sister. And she ended up falling in love, sort of love at first sight with Ralph, leaving her job as a school teacher and then going and living in, think about how remote that is today. Back in the 30s, the only way you could get there in the winter was to cross the lake on ice.
A pond in the river.
Yeah. Or Moosilik Maguntuk or the Richardson Lakes. So We Took to the Woods is her memoir of living in this remote area.
Off the grid. No electricity.
During the Depression.
Yeah.
When it's all loggers and woodsmen up there. And she loved fly fishing. She tied flies. And so it's a really warm, funny, well-written, timeless memoir that still sells a lot of copies because
great book.
People love it. And it's a bit of a time travel. You suddenly find yourself there in the 30s,
on Lower Dam, which is now gone, but it's the lowermost of the upper middle where they have the lodges there in Middle Dam. And then Lower Dam, which was a beautiful dam that was above the rock formations.
Yeah.
When I was there back in the late 90s, and I took all the pictures for magazines back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still see it.
Yeah.
But now it's gone. It started to fall.
The footings and stuff are there, but which I did fish there, but it was it's changed quite a bit up there, but the fishing is still superb.
Yeah. And back in the day when it wasn't as well known, it was like you could catch very, very large brook trout. And you still can. You just got to fight a crowd a little bit more than you used to.
Yeah.
And it's a little odd because it's behind like gates. You literally have
to
hike into it.
Hard to get in there, yeah.
But
yeah.
People love it, so they go in.
Exactly, exactly.
And it's a beautiful river.
It is, it is. And so Aldro actually let me take one of his ATVs and drive it down the old Cary Road to fish a couple of the ponds that were Louise's favorite, couple of holes that were her favorite holes.
Yeah.
So I got to experience a little more than I would have if I was on foot. But that was kind of nice because, I don't ordinarily hop on an ATV and
go fishing.
But
Aldro is a very, very special person.
He is. He was. He certainly made that a memorable couple of days.
He made it memorable many years for me because we've been close friends for many years, and I'll go up and just have dinner with him now and again, and just a great guy and a beautiful caretaker of a beautiful place, the Forest Lodge, where Louise Dickinson Rich, you can actually see the typewriter where she typed the book on there at the lodge.
Well, he donated some of the memorabilia speaking of museums, to the Outdoor Sporting Heritage Museum in Aquasic.
Yep.
And so they now have a more complete Louise Dickinson Rich exhibit there. And Bill Pierce, who runs that museum, that is a world-class museum. And I went to almost all of them, and that one is right up there. So that's kind of cool that, Aldro spent a lot of years trying to keep that legacy and the keep it as essentially a living museum.
A pristine,
environment. And the land belongs to the Rangeley Lakes Heritage Trust, and I know the buildings are all still there, but I'm not 100% sure what the future plans are for the Forest Lodge. I'd like to know.
Yeah, so won't we all.
Yeah.
Well, now you're heading back towards home, and You reach home, you greet Cheryl after being 6 weeks away. Yeah. Tell us about the greeting and tell us about kind of how you wrapped up your trip.
Well, so this is a little funny story. I wasn't sure where I was going to stay for this whole 6 weeks. I figured I'd stay with friends, some of it. I'd stay in, you know, cheapo motels for part of it, and then I would camp. So I took the big tent with me.
Yeah.
And didn't end up camping.
Okay.
Really at all until like the last night. And meanwhile,
Cheryl, you had to say you did it.
Well, Cheryl had gone camping with some of their friends. And
she ended up camping more than you.
No, so she's camping, and she's in the two-person tent with two of her friends. So they got three of them jammed in this tent. And I've got the big tent, and I'm not using it. So
I had to use it
the last night. That's
funny.
Otherwise, she would have killed me.
Yeah, you spent all this money in the tent. You got to go use it.
Yeah, right. So she still gives me grief about taking the tent when she could have used it. But it was great to get home. We actually connected when I came through Vermont. She drove over to Hanover, and we had dinner. And about 3 weeks into the trip, or no, 4 weeks into the trip, and then I still had another couple weeks to go. So I had seen her once in the 6 weeks, and then it was nice to get home and unwind and unpack and all that. But
start putting your thoughts and your stories together.
Yes, yes, very much.
How long did it take to write it?
Well, as I said, I blogged real time while I went.
Okay.
So that was kind of my first draft. And then I pitched that to some publishers, and Stackpole liked it. And so then I had to turn the blog into
a book.
A book.
Yeah.
And when you're writing a blog, yesterday is yesterday and tomorrow is tomorrow.
Right.
But when you're writing the book, it's all past tense.
Right.
So you have to go back and explain stuff.
Rework
a little
that.
More. So it took me a little over a year to completely rewrite it. And
the photos are mostly yours? Or?
They're all mine, except for one or two.
And then the artwork we had mentioned earlier, but we didn't mention it on the podcast. Tell us about the artwork, because it's beautiful.
Yeah, so Jill Osgood is a good friend of mine. She's a really amazing naturalist and artist. And I asked her to if she would be interested in doing some ink drawings of some of the big writers that I, my favorite big ones. So Corey Ford, Winslow Homer, Thoreau. And so she took photos or whatever we could find, and she did some original drawings of those, which I think came out gorgeous.
It's been a pleasure to spend time in it. It's like a lifetime of stories.
Well, first of all, Stackpole did a beautiful job with the layout and making my photos look nice. It's nice paper. It's a paperback, but it's high quality.
It's a glossy, yeah.
But the each story, I mean, I hope people will follow the journey, because it really does. It's a combination of the travel narrative, but also, like some writers that I admire, I tried to mix in some of the personal stories, a little bit about the writers, a little bit about the nature and the ecology of each river, and then, of course, what I call fishing porn, which is, you got pictures of fish with no clothes on. So, but that's just, trying to hit different audiences. And it was a lot of fun to do.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been great to have you on the podcast, Dave. It's Stackpole Books. You can pick up a copy at any of the fly fishing shows, because they'll have copies at the shows. If David is here, he'd be more than happy to sign it for you in the author's booth. If they're not going to catch you at the show, David, how would they pick up a copy of the book?
Well, I'm pleased because of Stackpole that it's a lot of bookstores. I've talked to a number of people who just bought it in their local bookstore.
That's awesome.
Which is great. I also have it for sale on my website, which is called watchyourbackcast.com. And if you're a fly fisher, that's pretty easy to remember, Watch Your Backcast. And I can do signed copies that people order through my website.
Copy.
I mail them a signed copy. You can also get it on any other online retailer, or most major book dealers have it.
Well, that's very cool. So watchyourbackcast.com.
Yeah.
David, I am going to encourage you to go write more books, because it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
To enjoy some of the stories, both close to home and then abroad and in the Driftless area that I haven't been to yet. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely looking forward to doing that. And you brought back some great memories of some of my fly fishing journeys. So,
Well, it seems like when I walked by your booth and I saw fly fishing journeys, I was like, I think I need to talk to that guy.
Yeah. It's definitely been a symbiotic thing here, because we have some of the same journeys. So,
yeah, that's great. Thank you.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.